applause, the blunt sadness and the fatality of life, the way the song doesn't end so much as it peters out. And now it's his funeral song, so it can't be mine. Or maybe it can. Maybe funerals are different than weddings, and people don't remember them and talk about them blow by blow. The Michael Penn orchestral dirge slows down and the song slips into silence. The lights come up. It's my turn. Love kisses me. I step toward the podium. I think we all need a moment of silence, I say. It's the right move, and I bow my head, and everyone does what I do. I have never understood why an Armani suit should cost so much money until now. As I stand here, anticipating, trying not to stare at Reese Witherspoon, and readying my pages, I take the mic. Good afternoon, I begin. My name is Joe Goldberg, and I am so blessed to know the Quinns, my surrogate family. I eulogize the fuck out of 40 Athol Quinn. And it's lucky that I got a head start when I thought he had drowned in the desert. It had to be altered because of his freak end, but the rewrite is good. Great even, and I should have a job writing eulogies. The best ones celebrate the person's potential. They emphasize that person's unique contribution to society. I talk about 40 calling me old sport the very first time we met. My audience is loving this, and I seize this opportunity to educate them. I tell them about one of my favorite books, and I'm sure most of them haven't read it because most of these people focus their energies on reading fictional narratives. But there's important nonfiction out there that's useful at a time like this, particularly for 40 Quinn. The book is called Life's Dominion, I begin, and it poses a philosophical question. Anyone could stand up here and speak to 40's charming wit, his burgeoning brilliance, his generosity, his swagger, his madras shorts and madcap sense of adventure, his extensive knowledge of film and his idealist sense of commitment. We've seen his smile, his joy, I say, pointing at the wall where his life just played out. But what you can't see in those pictures is 40's philosophy about life itself. And this is where I think I can best pay tribute to him by telling you about Life's Dominion. I take a deliberate, staged breath. The book poses a question we face every day, all day. What is the right choice? A bus is packed with adults, all of whom have lived, all of whom have mortgages and children, attachments. And there is a stroller crossing the street. The bus can break and go off the cliff and everyone dies, or the bus can run over the stroller and the child goes. Amy Adams tilts her head. Walk is wrapped. Ronald Dworkin argued that there is no universal right or wrong because it's valid to say that life is valued based upon what one has already done. But it's also possible to say that life can't be qualified, that the baby might have gone on to cure cancer, to win an Oscar. I know my crowd. I see people whispering, wondering who I am. 40 Quinn was a unique man. He was the baby in the stroller, the one with everything ahead of him, the potential we all know about. These scripts he sold, after working so hard for so many years to forge connections and get better, he earned his success, and it would be remiss to say that anything was handed to him because he grew up running around here, I say. Amy Adams nods. Quinn's give, and 40 gave us his stories, the ones he tried so hard to tell year after year. I shake my head. Megan Fox uncrosses her legs. She wants me. I mention Life's Dominion in Ronald Dworkin because something you might not have known about 40 Quinn was how much he read, how much he wrote, how passionate he was about learning. That's the thing about the charade of love. Nobody gets mad when you don't back up your lofty statements about someone's triumphant life with tangible facts. I look at Love and she smiles. She likes this story I'm telling because the truth would be terrible. He told me how much he learned from Life's Dominion shortly before. I trail off. Reese wipes her eyes, and Love's tears are soaking her dad's jacket. Let me say what we all know. 40 was a giant. He was a force. He was one of the people on the bus, one of us, a person with deep ties in the community, a person who spread his joy everywhere he went. Mrs. Quinn, if you'll cover your ears, I can tell you how much they loved him at Taco Bell. I get laughs through tears, and I wait for my silence. Very few people are able to straddle those quadrants of life. 40 is the only person I've ever known who could do that. He could play with toys. He could make you feel like the best was yet to come. And he could make you feel like what you'd done was worth everything. I tear up, and then I am closing. 40 Quinn called me the professor, but 40 Quinn was my professor. Walk smiles. We are going to be friends. Once I asked 40 what it was like to grow up with so much privilege. He told me that it was hard. He told me that when you have parents who embody the best of human love, parents who love each other more as time passes, who live to love, that it was hard to be constantly misunderstood by people who assumed that his wealth was purely financial. The thing about my parents, he said, is they could have been working in the pantry behind the register, in the deli, and they would have provided love in me with just as much love. I pause. Love is sobbing now. Reese Witherspoon is leaning forward, and her agent husband has an arm around her. I fucking win. 40 Quinn knew that love is all there is. Everything else is transient, impermanent. If he had made it across that street, I can guarantee you that he would have gotten out of the jaywalking ticket. You could not say no to 40 Quinn. He was the other kind of yes man. The kind who makes us all want to say yes. Rest in peace, brother. When I return to love, she transfers her trembling body from her father's embrace to mine. This is the Godfather, and we spill out into a ballroom with bottles of Veuve everywhere and gigantic pictures of 40 that are projected onto the walls, changing. He is young, he is old, but either way, he is dead. Yes. Everyone I've ever wanted to meet is here, and they want to meet me. And Reese Witherspoon wants to hug me, yeah she does, and her husband wants to talk to me, and Walk wants to get a drink, and Love is proud of her book-selling boyfriend, crushed and destroyed, but proud. Barry Stein takes me aside. Do you like cigars? He asks. Absolutely, I say, and he will be useful in my negotiations with Megan Ellison. I will get Stein to offer to buy my shit and then turn around and make deals with ME. For now, it starts with friendship. 40 is right. I won't burn bridges. And first, I have to build them. I have to walk out onto the lawn and watch Barry Stein wrestle with his bow tie and search for a polite way to segue into business talk, as if there is a polite way to segue into business talk. He chews a cigar. He spits. You know, he says, 40 and I, we kicked some ideas around lately. You and I think we should talk. I nod. Absolutely. I think his work should not die with him. Absolutely. I smoke a cigar and Barry wants me to call his office and set up a meeting. Inside, the food is incredible. Kate Hudson is hugging me. There are crab cakes and antipasto. And drinks that never stop. Gimlets and steak tips that melt and cold chunks of lobster. 40's favorite songs play, most of them about the fucking drugs that almost killed him but didn't kill him, and George Clooney shakes my hand. Good speech, kid. And the greatest part of all of this is the beautiful truth of it. I killed it with my speech, and I did not kill 40 Quinn. It's silly to play games, to wonder how he might have lived. What was Julie Santos even doing in Beverly Hills? What if she had continued to go straight on Santa Monica all the way to the Pacific? It's like in Match Point with the tennis ball and then later with the ring. All of life is slightly dependent on magic. So is death. If his body had been found in the spring, if his skin had started to disintegrate, his shit staining the hot water, his body stuffed with cocaine, well, the funeral would be different. I mean, I would have killed it and found a way to bring the light, but it would have been a darker day. Thank God, if there is one, for Julie Santos and her left-hand turn. Cho, she says, and she is Susan Sarandon. She hugs me. She pulls away.
I just needed to do that.
I hope Reese saw, and I hope Amy saw, but what really matters the most is what Love saw. She wraps her arm around me.
You did so good, Love says. Do you even know?
It's not the time for me to brag, so I am humble, supportive, stroking her arm and kissing the top of her head, and she steps away, family obligations. People like 40 Quinn are their own worst enemies, increasing the odds of an untimely death by chugging codeine, and with his death, I am liberated. I can go anywhere I want, and I wander into the lobby, the pink and green of it all, freedom. I sit on a circular sofa, and Love finds me. She plants herself on my lap. She strokes my hair.
Let's stay at the Isles tonight, she says. I don't want to stay here. I want my own bed.
When a girl wants her own bed and she wants you in it, this is how you know it's real. Whatever you want, I say. And I will give it 4 weeks until I tell her that I'm inspired by 40's work, that I think I'd like to try writing something on my own. I put my hand on her stomach. 40 can't take this moment away. The quiet love in this ballroom, and the inaudible sound of a new heart beating. Chapter 54. I wake up early, happy. I'm still high on the funeral, on Kate's ass, Reese's eyes, Amy's intensity, my baby. And I missed it here at the Isles, the tennis court, the sand and the grass forever mixing, never melding. I'm a runner now, and the beach looks different to me, useful. It's my track. And what a great feeling it is to revisit the puzzle of your life and say, ah, I know what that beach is there for. It's there for me. My body doesn't want to sleep. I think it has something to do with all the change. The last time I was here, I killed Delilah. Love had no idea who I was, but she wanted to find out, so she invited me to go to the film set with her. She stood on that beach and watched me coming in on the Donzie, and she did not know where I had been or why I had been out there. The miracle of life, of the girl in my bed. She loves me more now than she did then. And now there is so much new love in my life, meetings and opportunities and purpose. I will take care of Love. I will honor 40's legacy and see his projects to fruition. I will be strong for my child, and I will protect myself. I am too happy to be still, and Love is like Sleeping Beauty. Her twin is dead. This will take a while. I kiss her perfect little forehead, and I put on pink shorts with whales all over them, and I put on a t-shirt, and I grab my sunglasses, and I leave Love's room. I hum Thunder Road. And I walk through the house that 40 will never walk through again. It's real. And I smile. Outside, I walk down the path, barefoot on the sandy grass, the grassy sand. I hear the waves and they are slow and lazy, and when I reach the beach, I am startled because there is a mist as dense as snow. A Stephen King kind of mist, thick and white. Suddenly, I am a kid again. And monsters could live in this mist, and how surreal it is to hear the water but not be able to see it. I remember feeling this happy once when I was a kid. Snow covered the streets and they were perfect and white, as if the world had been coated in vanilla ice cream. My mom said school was canceled and I could go outside. I'd seen snow before, but there was something about the snow that day. It was early, before the people would come and destroy it all. And I clomped outside, and it was up to my knees, and I was the first one to walk in it, and I was so fucking happy to be first, to see my footprints, giant and deep, to know that I had all day, that there would be no school, no homework. There is magic in a snow day, and how strange it must be to grow up in Southern California without that possibility. It will be my first question for Love when she wakes up. I walk into the mist toward the water, and I hear a dog barking. Boots and puppies. I whistle. The dog barks. He sounds afraid. It's okay, I call out. Come here, boy. But he only mews, sounding almost like a kitten. Hey, little guy, it's okay. I pat the sand. I am reminded of the puppy in Single White Female that won't run to Jennifer Jason Leigh.
and then she kills the puppy because it didn't love her. And then I think of 40 murdering Roosevelt, Love's version, and Love crying when their parents gave Boots away, 40's version. There really is no such thing as the truth, but there is such a thing as happiness, and I can picture the amazed look on Love's face if I brought her home this dog. Dogs like authority, so I command. All right, get over here, pup, right now. But the whimpering sounds farther away. I start running, making my way through the swirling white, and 15 yards in, I stumble and stub my toe. Fuck. Sand is harder than you think. Would you just come here already? I'm not gonna hurt you. I keep going, and the puppy is still crying out there somewhere. It's okay, I'm here. The ocean ebbs and flows beyond the fog, and I hear the dog again, and I crouch. I want to be prepared to hug him, to get coated in puppy slobber, to be loved. This is why people in Franklin Village keep dogs. And I think I see him. He is as white as the mist, with a little black mouth and black eyes and a pink tongue coming into focus. The dog is panting, running, and I wonder what we'll call him. He looks like a Charlie or a Cubby or a George. I whistle to him. He ignores me. Fucker. I laugh. What is wrong with me? It's a puppy. It's not a fucker. But then maybe it is. Babies can be assholes and puppies can be fuckers. But you accept the risk when you make a baby, when you adopt a dog. I think I'll write something about an asshole baby and a fucker puppy, and it will be like one of those old school Peanuts cartoons, where you can't hear what the adults are saying because it's all just sonic wonking. I clap my hands, and that's when I see a flash of white linen, a bright yellow shirt, and I realize the dog isn't alone. The puppy yelps, and the human throws something, an electric green tennis ball. The human whistles, and the human is female. I see her hair in the mist, blonde, tangled, and I see her sharp shoulders and two long legs and... Amy? 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 She scoops the puppy that was going to belong to me in Love into her arms. She kisses the puppy, and then she looks up. She startles. Joe, she says. She looks terrified, guilty. Time stops. I am in shock. She holds the puppy too hard, and the puppy fights, and the puppy has claws, and the puppy wins. She drops the puppy, and it runs, and she stands there, frozen, and this bitch fucked me. Stole from me, tricked me, lied to me, used me. She wronged me and the nice people in Rhode Island, Liam and Pearl and Harry and Noah, and I loved her. I loved her, but she didn't love me. Amy. Amy. What are you doing here? She asks, and she thinks she's pretty and clever, tucking her hair behind her ear, pretending to trust me. But people don't change, and I see her bracing to run. She doesn't get to run away from me now the way she did then, not after what she did. She turns, hair flying, and instinct takes over. I spring forward. She runs, but I'm faster, and I knock her to the ground. She screams, and I clamp my hand over her mouth and look into the eyes I know too well. She knees me in the groin, and I react, loosening my grip. But I manage to grab her by the hair and pin her down in the sand. I cover her mouth again, and she thrashes like a marlin, and I can't believe that after all these months, Amy is here. Her face has changed from all this sun. More freckles, smoother skin, longer hair, crusty mascara around her eyes. She was out last night. She is who I used to love, who I used to covet, who I used to want to kill, but who I forgot to worry about after I fell in love with Love. She kicks me again, and I smack her face. Don't scream, I say. Understand? She says yes with her eyes. They are as bright as I remember, even in the mist. I take my hand away. Jesus, Joe, what are you doing? Shut up, I command. I clamp my hand over her mouth. You are not to yell, do you understand? She nods emphatically. Joe, please, she begins. I'm still getting reacquainted with her face, how crazy human faces are, how noses are all so different, some bulbous, some pointy. Amy's is aquiline. I used to love her nose. I used to kiss her nose. Now I love Love's nose. Joe, she says, about the money. The money? I can't help it. It's been so long, but it all washes over me again. The humiliation I felt when I found my computer in the cage, the keys I made for her, the note in Charlotte and Charles. How can you think this is about money?
'Cause I lifted the books, she pants. I can pay you back.
I don't want your fucking money, Amy, I say. I'm not like you. I don't give a fuck about money.
I get it, okay? I suck, but please let me go, she begs.
I hold her down. You do suck. You're a vicious, empty cunt.
You're acting crazy, she says. Let me go.
I spit at her. She blinks. Fuck you, I say.
Joe, she says. Please stop it.
I tighten my grip on her neck. I should get it over with. I should squeeze the life out of her for all the things she did do. Instead, I am allowing her to speak, to rail on about what she did.
I took some books, she confesses. And it sucks, and I know it, and I know it must have been terrible for you to find out, but you know, Joe, you knew I was in it for myself. I know you knew.
I didn't know. And this is what hurts. I loved her, and she did not love me. She didn't think it was real. She never did. My cheeks turn red. I need to kill her because she says things like, we were just fucking and it was summer and I didn't rip you off. I ripped off the shop. She wasn't in love with me, and every time she promises she can get me the money, I know I have to kill her. She wasted my heart, my time. She begs me to let her go, and she can get a cash advance, and she can get you anything you want, and she is house-sitting, and there is art I could sell, like a lot of art, and she is a commercial beast. Beck never loved me either. And if love knew about this, the dark, humiliating truth of it, that I love women who don't love me back, I don't know how I could look her in the eye. I don't know if I could go on, because the real horror of my life is not that I've killed some terrible people. The real horror is that the people I've loved didn't love me back. I may as well have been masturbating in the cage, telling the books about the girls, because all the girls before love, they were not there with me, not really, especially this one, this tall blonde cunt begging for her life and promising me that she can give it all back to me, every last penny. You don't get it, I tell her. There's nothing you can do.
Let me go, she pleads. She squirms.
Everything in her tone and her language and her eyes seems confused. She's acting like I'm some guy she knew, and I'm looking at her like she broke my heart. But she's just talking about what a pain it was to sell books online. Does she really think this is about Portnoy's complaint? About Yates? What about everything you wrote in Charlotte and Charles? She swallows.
What?
Charlotte and Charles, I snap. You read it to me on the beach, and a day later you run out on me and write me a letter in it, and I want to know why.
'Cause it was in my bag from the beach when I went back to the shop, she exclaims.
And that is not what I was asking about. You read the book to me on the beach, and you left me a note in the book, and now you want to tell me you don't remember?
Joe, she says, I told you. You were looking in my phone. I mean, you didn't trust me either.
Why did you leave that book for me? I ask. She asks me to let her go. I ask her to tell me about the book. The air is cold and loud off the water, and she groans again.
Because you're so sad and lonely, she says. Jesus, if this is it, fuck it. I give up.
She smacks her lips. She clears her throat.
Get off me, she says. Get off me and I'll tell you.
No, I say. Tell me now.
I left you that book because I did feel bad, she says. You're sad and lonely and you should be better at being alone. You're just so fucking depressed and you wear it like a badge the way you sit in that shop alone. And you're so obviously desperate for someone to come in and change your life and it's fucking annoying. Like, take care of your shit. Pull yourself together. Stop being so self-conscious about your music and every little thing you say. I gave you that book because those giants are pathetic. The way they can't fucking deal with themselves and they expect everyone to be as decent as they are. They have no right to be shocked when the humans gang up on them. Like, that's fucking life. Get over it. You can't go around expecting everyone to be like you. That's the point.
Her words sting. If I'm so depressed and pathetic, then why did you date me? She rolls her eyes.
Joe, she says, the day we met, I was using my ex-boss boyfriend's credit card and you didn't call the cops.
I'm not judgmental.
You have to see things as they are, she says. I mean, I didn't try and fool you or anything. And you know, I was like, okay, this guy, he's so cool with my shady shit. He obviously has his own shady shit. There's no way around it.
I am nothing like you. I hurt her, finally, and she shifts.
Well, congratulations, she says. Can I go now? I mean, come on, this is ridiculous. What are you going to do, kill me?
Amy Adam has no idea about me. She thinks I'm a lonely, sad person with poor reading comprehension skills. She used me. She isn't smart enough to love me or know me, and suddenly I feel sorry for her. She doesn't understand that Charlotte and Charles is about the resilience of the human spirit, that happy people get fucked over and swim to another island and buck up and go on again. Amy is not a con artist, and she's not a conniving thief. She's a sad, lonely girl. She carried a book around that she didn't even understand, and she wants the world to be like a Richard Yates book, with sad endings. The only Philip Roth book she ever finished is Portnoy's Complaint. She isn't the girl I thought she was, talking to me now about her boss, her dog sitting, and I am not gonna kill her. In a strange way, Amy Adam is right. I am incapable of killing anyone right now. I have love. I'm gonna be a father. I have changed. I move off her completely, and she wipes the sand off her arms, off her shirt. She shakes her legs.
Only thing about the beach, she gripes. Sand.
From her end, this was a lover's quarrel, and so we do what all former lovers do. We revisit our past together. But our memories are so different. I bring up that last night in Little Compton. Remember our new best friends, Noah and Pearl and Harry and Liam? I ask. She is aghast.
You remember their names? How do you remember their names?
She is not like me, not like love. She is not burdened with a sensitive heart. Hers just beats. She laughs.
Remember when I busted you looking in my phone?
I get a ripple of humiliation in my stomach. Uh-huh, I say. You were mad.
Yeah, she says. Paranoid. I had already put a couple books online and looked for a sublet out here. I was like, fuck, he found out.
Wow, I say. And I think of Match Point, where Woody Allen reminds us all the best tennis players are also lucky. Amy had a lot of Safari windows open on her phone that day. I only saw the one with Henderson. If she had to wait in line, if she'd washed her hands more thoroughly, if she'd put on lipstick, I would have found these other windows. I had bad luck with her, but then again, without her, I never would have found love.
I know, she says. I mean, I pitched a fit because I thought you knew what I was up to and you were going to want to talk and all that.
She asks me what I'm doing in LA and I tell her I moved here because it was something to do, because it was time to get out of New York. She said she might move to Austin. I tell her it seems like a lot of assholes talk about moving to Austin. She laughs.
You are funny, she says. You still got it, Goldberg.
I feel nothing. I don't yearn for what we had, the way all we could do was mock everyone else. I gaze at the ocean, but I can't see through the mist. She pulls her hair over her left shoulder. Her neck is bruised, proof of my violence. A new mug of piss. My heart starts to beat fast, and maybe I do have to kill her. I hurt her. I did this. And if I do away with her, I will never have to worry about her ever again. She won't be a loose end, another mug of urine. I could do it. She draws in the sand with her finger. That could be her last act as a human. But then the tide creeps up on us and recedes and the line vanishes, just like the redness on her neck will. Nature is an inherently forward beast. Footsteps disappear, past hurts fade. I won't kill Amy. I will not remove life from this planet while Love and I are in the process of bringing life into this world. I've already confessed my past to Love, and I don't want to confess my present. I stand and I offer Amy a hand, but she stands up without my help. She asks if I'm sure I don't want money for the books.
I tell her I'm good, and she smiles, then turns, and walks back into the mist. She keeps her head down and her arms crossed. I sit back down in the sand where she lay, cool and wet, and I feel the weight go, as if she's passing out of me every time I breathe, every time I blink. I can't tell you the specific moment that I can't see her anymore because she disappears in segments. First, the mist takes her bare feet, then the back of her yellow shirt. Her hair comes back to me for a brief spell, blonde, tangled. And then it's gone, and then she's gone, all of her, into the mist. Almost like she was never here at all. Chapter 55. It's so different being at Taco Bell with Love. She already has pregnancy cravings and wanted to pig out on enchiladas and gorditas. Twins. But we don't order everything on the menu, just gorditas and two chicken tacos. She wants soda even though she feels bad about the sugar, and I tell her we'll start a better diet tomorrow. She asks me to pick a booth, and I choose one by the window, far from the one where I always sat with 40. She fills up our cups with ice and mixes a little root beer into our Cokes. I kinda love this, she says. Me too, I say. Maybe we should get married here. Did you just propose to me in Taco Bell without a ring? I nod. She laughs. She thinks she peed her pants, and I tell her you don't get to pee your pants when you're a few weeks pregnant. We hold hands across the table. So will you? I ask. Yes, she smiles. But don't make me a ring out of a straw or anything, okay?
Deal, I say. We wait for the feast and we talk about the baby's room and where to live and when to tell people. I tell her I think I want to write something. Maybe even this idea I've been kicking around about a ghostwriter called Fakers. She says she likes the title, fucking right she does. And she says 40 could tell I was a writer the day we met. We watch the cars go by on the PCH and we rehash the funeral and she says my eulogy was the greatest thing ever and she wants to watch the video tonight.
Is that weird? She asks.
Not at all, I tell her. Death is weird.
When our food is ready, I walk to the counter and I thank the guy. He's new. He doesn't know me and he'll never know 40. Love bites into her gordita and half of it falls on her shirt and now I think I piss myself laughing and I pick up a chicken taco and shove it in my mouth so that half of it falls onto my shirt on purpose and now she's laughing. I slide out of the booth and she keeps her eyes on me and only Love is sexy with gordita all over her shirt. I move to her side of the table and I feel her react to me. I actually feel the love well up inside of her, in her legs, in the way they shift toward me, so slightly. Petals to the sun. When I kiss her, she quivers like we just met, and she strokes my back like we've known each other forever. I love you, I say.
Me too, she says.
I am smiling ear to ear. If this is how we are after her brother's shocking death and our surprise pregnancy, imagine how good we're gonna be when we don't have any stress in our lives. Okay, actually, I do have to pee. I say, and I nod to the guy at the counter on the way to the bathroom. It's one of those bathrooms with a permanently fogged mirror that's mostly just splinters and graffiti, and I can't see my reflection. After I flush, I wash my hands, more than Amy did at Dell's that day in May. I press the button for the air to come out of the hand dryer, but it's broken. Someday, if I meet the owner of Taco Bell, I will advise him to renovate these fucking bathrooms. I will explain that my wife and I, wife, like to go to his establishment every so often. I will tell him we would go more often if the bathrooms weren't so disgusting. I push through the door, excited to tell Love about my plans to renovate the bathrooms, and stop short. Her gordita is sitting there as fat as it was when I left, but she's not at the booth. And the guy at the counter is gone too. The kitchen is silent, and outside the PCH is empty. Nothing. Not a single BMW. Goosebumps cover my body, and I run into the women's bathroom, but every stall is vacant. My phone rings, echoing in the vast silence of this deserted Taco Bell. It is Love, and I silence the call because I know now what this is.
Love retrieved the mug of urine, but the mug of urine was not my only mistake. I'm sure of it. The only other possible explanation for the vacuum of silence is an atomic meltdown, in which case the sky would be orange. I turn on the faucet. The soap in here is newer, pinker. I wonder if my child will be a boy or a girl. I wash my hands with hot water and I rinse with cold water. This is my last trip to the spa for a while. And I push the dryer and the hot air blows. I close my eyes and let my hands take on the heat. My phone is ringing again. Love. They're making her call me to see what's taking so long. They do shit like that in Dennis Lehane books. But you can't hold it against them. Their job is to get me. And they must want me very badly because the perimeter has been cleared. That's why there's no one at the register and no cars on the PCH. If I had been a gentleman, I would have let Love go to the bathroom first and I would have been the one to watch the cops sweep in, stealthy and silent. I pull the door and exit the women's restroom. I memorize the tiles on the floor of this Taco Bell and I take one last bite of Love's gordita, and this is it. I pull the first door and enter the vestibule. I open the second door and enter the parking lot. The sun pierces my eyes. There is a cop on the roof above me. "Put your hands up," he says. I do. He reads me my Miranda rights, and cops pop up everywhere. From behind the parked cars, from around the side of the building, from the bushes. I don't care about them. I don't care that I am under arrest for the murder of Guinevere Beck and the murder of Peach Salinger. What I care about is Love. And she appears now with tears streaming down her face. She is trying to run from me, but they are holding her back. If she has a miscarriage because of the ridiculous, over-the-top antics of the United States federal justice system, I will kill each and every one of these people. All that evolved Charlotte and Charles shit about trust and optimism is good and all, but not when your pregnant wife is sobbing in the Taco Bell parking lot and she's got gordita all over her shirt and you can't do anything because you have to go to jail. But I don't have to worry. I'm one of the rich people now. The untouchables. These fuckers can't nail me. I'm gonna have the best lawyers money can buy. And let them try proving that I killed either one of those girls without a single shred of evidence, without the mug of urine Love got for me. I lock eyes with Love. I tell her I love her. She nods. Me too. The cop asks me if I'm done, and before I answer, he opens the door and shoves me into the back seat. This is real. This is not a minor traffic infraction where they give you a warning and ask you about New York. This is not a jaywalking ticket by some power-hungry cop. This is 2 counts of murder, 1, suspect in custody, over. Fuck you, radio. It's not over. Not even close. Chapter 56. The police are so fixated on the past, and I want to tell them that it's all gone. I'm a changed man. I saw Amy on the beach. Amy, the reason I moved here, the person who stole from me and broke my heart. And I didn't kill her. I'm not that guy anymore, and this seems relevant, but then legally, it isn't. My brain gorges with my defense, the one that I can't reveal because the case against me is not about Amy, damn it, though I wish it were. Here's the gist of it. Detective Peter Brinks and the New York Police Department are not like the feminist bloggers. They took the complaints of Dr. Nick Angevine seriously. One of his complaints was regarding patient X, one Danny Fox. They were unable to locate Danny Fox. It was like he didn't exist. Meanwhile, in Little Compton, Rhode Island, Officer Nico was spending a lot of time around the Salinger house. In police work, there is a lot of downtime, a lot of sitting around, a lot of coffee, a lot of waiting, and while he was sitting around doing nothing, Officer Nico decided it would be fun to flip through a sailing magazine. And in that sailing magazine, he saw a picture of a guy on a boat. The guy was identified as Spencer Hewitt. "I looked at that picture," he says, "and I thought, what are the odds that there are 2 guys named Spencer Hewitt?" Even though the Salingers insisted on closing the book on Peach,
Officer Nico went to the garage that worked on my Buick. He wondered, do they have a record of that transaction, perhaps a license plate? And they did have a license plate number on a receipt. Officer Nico found that the car was registered to a Mr. Mooney. He read about the bookstore in some BuzzFeed article about old bookstores in New York. He saw the name Joe Goldberg, and then he found me on motherfucking Facebook. Fucking Facebook. He recognized me, and he brought the picture to the Salingers, and they knew me, of course, as the delivery boy, as the guy in the bar. So then the red flags were raised. Officer Nico was no dummy, and he knew Peach's friend Beck had also met an untimely end. I almost wish I could have been there on the day that Officer Nico visited Dr. Nicky in prison and showed him my photograph, fucking Facebook, and said, "Is this Danny Fox?" So that's how this maelstrom came together, like any storm system in nature, a confluence of circumstances. It's as absurd as me running into Amy on a beach in Malibu after hunting her in Hollywood for months. How things come together in this universe, how they don't, is unfair. I was so judicious with Amy. I let her go. I didn't punish her. I think the justice system should see where I am now, how far I've come, all the good I have to lose. They should stop prodding into my past. It's so vengeful, so middle school, the way they want to boil my entire life down into these two dead girls. And I had no warning of the coming storm, but because of love, I was able to batten down the hatches. I have a lawyer named Edmund, and he sits alongside me through every interrogation. He is my counsel. He nods when it's okay to answer, and he shakes his head when he wants me to be quiet. Edmund says to focus on the facts, and he reminds me that the cops have yet to produce any evidence that proves that I did anything. All they know for sure is that I like to use pseudonyms. In our first conversation, I reminded Detective Leonard Carr that lots of people use pseudonyms. "Look at authors," I said. "Look at famous people who check into hotels." It's been 3 days, and life is never how you expect it to be. The food here isn't bad. It isn't good, per se, but I'm not starving. In the newspapers, they call me Killer Joe. And it's disappointing. The failure of modern media, the lack of originality. Love visits me, her father too. At night, I worry. I wonder if there are other mugs of piss, if I forgot about them. I think about Charlotte and Charles. I daydream about love. I think about the baby running from love to me and then back again. I dream of the baby learning to walk and wake up ready to face my long days of cheap coffee and interrogations. Leonard Carr is the good cop. He says I'm too smart to bother with bad cop, and he says he won't bore me with head games. But of course, he's boring me with head games. He thinks I'll relax and accidentally admit to killing someone. He has kids. He should know better. But then he's human. We all are. After lunch, he returns to the windowless room where we have our talks. He offers me water and kicks his feet up. "So," he says, "I've been thinking about Wolf of Wall Street." There is something springy about him, and I break my rule about looking at the camera. The one focused on me all the time, all day. The glass orb hell-bent on capturing me as I incriminate myself. Edmund nudges my leg, a reminder to stay calm. Detective Carr has new information. I know it. He's excited, trying so hard not to show it that he's showing it. But then, maybe that's part of his strategy. "Here's what I like about the movie," he says. "I like it when the guy eats the goldfish. He's so simple. Something about it that stayed with me. I've never seen anyone eat a goldfish, have you?" "No," I say, and I wonder what he knows. I am thirsty, but I don't drink the water.
"Not ever?" he asks.
"No," I say. I would like to open his skull and find out what he knows so we can avoid this banter and I can get out of here and go on with my life. He nods.
"You didn't see anything like that in Cabo?"
I look to Edmund. He nods.
"No," I say. "I didn't see anyone eat a goldfish in Cabo."
Fincher. What the fuck do they know about Fincher? My heart beats loud.
I tell it to stop. It doesn't listen to me. I do not control my heart. Nobody does. Detective Carr is still nodding, torturing me, scratching his neck. Hey, he says. How's your buddy Brian? Captain fucking Dave. I swallow. He's fine. Now, he sounds like a party animal to me, right? He laughs. A guy like that, I bet he would swallow a goldfish, yeah? I don't know, I say. Detective Carr stares at the wall. Edmund stares at me. There is a unique silence to this room, and I know what happened. Captain Dave is a fearful man. Rules are rules, Joe. And when the cops asked him about our time in Cabo, he forked over every detail. He told them that my imaginary friend Brian, the one I invented when I was trying to get the boat so I could dump Fincher's body. Now the police are going to want to talk to Brian, and there are probably others on this case, cops poring over airline records, passport records, cops trying to find Brian the American who went to Cabo San Lucas. They aren't going to find Brian, but they are going to realize that a cop named Robin Fincher flew to Cabo. They are going to see that he disappeared while I was in Cabo, and I love love, but this is America. If you kill a cop, they don't let you go. Cops protect their own. They are the ultimate family, loyal to the end. How'd you meet Brian? Detective Carr asks. At a party, I say. Henderson's party? Nice try, fucker. No, I say. I didn't meet him at Henderson's party. Henderson, of course, is their favorite thing to talk about. The fact that I was there, that I was in his house, on YouTube, the night that he died. They think it's too much coincidence, but they have no evidence. Sounds like you guys aren't close, he says. We aren't, I say. The days are long in here. I will not complain when I am free, staying up around the clock, helping take care of the baby. Why did Love hate him so much? I look at him. Huh? He smiles. I fucked up. Huh was the wrong thing to say. They're asking her right now, he says. Just one of those things, you know. We're curious about you, Joe. The kind of people you run with and all. I don't know why she hated him, I say. And this is that newlyweds game show from before I was born, where they test your knowledge of your partner. But it's not fair. We are not playing for a fucking vacation to Cabo. We are playing for my life, for my right to be a father to my child. My child. Love and I did not sign up for this, but I have to play. Take a guess, he says. He gets a text. He reads the text. He nods. Huh, he says. He is imitating me. He has Love's answer, and I don't have Love's answer, and I don't know what she would say. Joe, you don't have to answer. Edmund reminds me, but he's wrong. I do. Detective Carr isn't going to leave the room until I answer a question about someone who doesn't exist, or I will be one step closer toward a life without love. Milo will raise my baby. My baby will run into his arms. My mind swirls. Brian doesn't exist. There is no Brian. But Love answered the question. What did she say? This is like in Magnolia when the kid breaks down. I am cracking under pressure, and Detective Carr knows it. He knocks his phone against the table, and this is the sound of my life ending. Are you thirsty? Detective Carr nudges the water toward me. Go ahead, he says. Trust me, we didn't slip anything in there. I look at him, and I am doing it again, digging my own grave. Does he know about the cactus? Was there a camera at the house? Was there a camera in the sky, a drone? He sips his water. When did Love meet Brian? He asks. Did she meet him before you left town to do the movie, or did she meet him in Palm Springs? He could be lying. Love could have refused to answer the question. She might be playing the same game as I am. I try to imagine that I am Love, pregnant, in love, and there is a man asking me questions, and if I say the wrong thing, the man I love so much will be gone. My heart beats faster and faster, and I wish I could carry it around in a rolling suitcase. It's annoying the way it's connected to my other bodily functions, The way my little motherfucker pores allow sweat to weep upon my forehead. The way my asshole pupils shrink and expand and I can't control them. I'm not a fucking sociopath. Detective Carr puts his feet up on the desk again. Joe, he says, what was Brian's last name? Love can't remember. Do you remember? Edmund looks at me meaningfully. No, I say. I don't remember. I don't remember. The magic words, according to my attorney, according to Love. If I just keep saying I don't remember things, I will be out of here soon. I will not let Detective Carr break me. Love and I shouldn't be playing the newlywed game. We're not even married yet. I will my heart to take it easy, and I sip the water, and I can't wait for this session to be over. I look forward to returning to my cage. I feel empowered when I'm in there, locked up. Love is the key to happiness in life, and I have no doubt that it will set me free. Love and Edmund, that's all I need, and I have it all. And I know that if I believe in love and play by the rules, say nothing, remember nothing, say as little as possible, say nothing, I know I will be out of here soon, watching my child break out of Love's vagina, my favorite place in the world. If Love were here, in this room, she would wrap her arms around me and tell me why she hates Brian, what his last name is, share with me all the elaborate and specific details of when and where they met, how he offended her. I know it's ludicrous to say such a thing. After all, Brian doesn't exist. They never met. I invented him so I could get access to one of the boats. So because there is no such thing as Brian, there is nothing for Love to know. And yet I know she would know, because that's the thing about feeling so connected to someone, so entrenched, so attached. I believe she knows me better than I know myself, and hopefully I know her as well too. Joe, he says. Yeah. How did Love and Brian meet? I say nothing. What would Love say? What's his last name? I say nothing. What would Love say? Why does she hate this guy? I say nothing. What would Love say? I know Love, and I have to believe in myself right now. I have to walk out onto the plank, and I have to jump. I stop sweating. My heart resets, and my pores rest. This is it. First of all, I begin, I barely know that Brian guy. And the thing is, Love doesn't hate him. He swallows, and it's an unmistakable sign that I passed the test. Love told the cops the same thing, and I remember her exact words in the pool that day, talking about Sam the work bitch, our conversation in Little Compton about 40. I don't hate anyone, she said. When you love someone, you listen. You remember it all. Truthfully, I say, Love doesn't really hate anybody. He clenches his jaw. Yeah, he says. So I heard. Inside, I pump my fist. I knew it. I know her. I love her. But most people in love face obstacles, and here is ours. Detective Carr, back again, firing away. But you told Captain Dave that Love hates this guy. Why? I didn't want to go here. Ray and Dottie have been through enough. I work up some tears. My lawyer asks for a minute, but I say no. Look, detective, I can't stress this enough. I'd rather Ray and Dottie not know that 40 was involved with this, but well, fuck. Brian was 40's friend, I say, and it's the money shot. My would-have-been brother-in-law saving me from the great beyond. I just met him in Cabo. He and 40 got really fucked up, and 40 didn't want to just leave him out there, but he was too fucked up to deal with it himself. I shrug. I was just trying to do him a solid. Why not let him crash at the party? La Grosseria has more than a few spare bedrooms. Detective Carr is the one sweating now, drumming his fingers on the table, and this is the beauty of reasonable doubt. He may suspect that I'm making this all up, but at the end of the day, he can't prove that, and 40's not around to tell him differently. Because it was our rap party, I say. It wasn't a free-for-all. Who else met this Brian? Anyone alive, I mean? He asks. I shrug. I don't remember. I was worried I would sound sarcastic, like a senator's son at a date rape trial, but I didn't. I pulled it off.
I took a leap of faith and made an educated guess on what love said, and I guessed correctly. I did it. We did it. Detective Carr is standing, irritated. He says it's odd the way I know so many people who don't fucking exist anymore, and I let him rant. I don't tell him that the last person who said that to me wound up dead. I have my priorities in order. Love comes first, above all. She is patient and kind, as the Corinthians say, and I bring patience and kindness into this room as I watch this poor bastard pace. He's older than me, more tired. He probably lives in Torrance, in some house full of Bud Light and expired coupons and firearms and soiled diapers. It can't be easy being a cop in California, and he's not very photogenic or articulate. I bet he never wanted to be an actor, and I bet he wasn't in love with his wife when he proposed to her. I bet he was just with her, and I bet she was dropping hints, and I bet he was one of those guys who proposes because he's 30, because he figures it's time to get married and settle down. I bet there was no love in his heart when he got down on one knee and asked the girl to marry him. Not any more than usual, I mean. You can't tell me anything else about Brian? I'm sorry, I say. For all I know, that wasn't even his real name. Don't fuck with me. I'm not fucking with you, I say. I met him briefly. He was Forty's friend, and Forty knew some shady people, you know? He did drugs, he got around. It's bad luck to speak ill of the dead. I'm not speaking ill, I say. I'm trying to help you guys out. Detective Carr sits in his chair. In a way, I think it would be terrible to live in L.A., devoid of aspirations. How would you do it? How would you put up with the traffic and the monotony of the sun, the way people use the word hella and lie so freely? How could you stand it here if you weren't striving for something better? Oh, that's right. He liked The Wolf of Wall Street. He aspires to take someone down like me, a serial killer. But he chose the wrong guy. I am done with all that. And I will not let my past dictate my future. He rubs his forehead. You know, Joe, he says, we have all our officers looking for Brian. You do know that we will find him. We're going to make sure he's okay. We're checking hotel records and we're going to find out all of it. Who he was, what you did with him, why. Okay, I say. Okay, he says, and I feel bad for him. He's so close. And he's gonna get closer. He'll come in here tomorrow talking about The Godfather Part 3 and asking me if I heard about a cop disappearing in Mexico. A guy named Fincher who also visited the set of Boots and Puppies. But the thing is, it's all circumstantial evidence. It's not enough to keep me here. I was very good at killing people when I needed to be. Was. The past tense. I'm retired. And really, when you grow up and get over yourself, when you fuck narcissism and leave the hashtags at the door, you see what really matters in life. What matters is what you do next. I get it. And this is America. You have to prove that someone did something, and they can't prove that I did anything. In Fast Five, Dom is in a prison bus, glum. His friends force the bus to crash so they can free him. But my team doesn't have to do that for me. They won't be able to convict me or get me on a bus because there is no evidence of my past actions. Well, aside from the baby growing inside of love. Prison isn't that bad, and I treasure the solitude. From everything I know about parenting, I expect that in a few months I'll be glad I got to spend some time alone before becoming a father. We all need to be with our thoughts. Angelinos like to meditate and stare at expensive statues of Buddha, and I stare at the cement. Same difference. I learn to smile at everyone, and I feel the world reciprocate. The guards are polite, and then when I'm not alone, I'm in the room. I kind of like it in there, the way Detective Carr challenges me every day. My lawyer says I'm damn good under pressure. This is all great research for my screenwriting career, and I can see myself writing a movie that takes place during a trial. I use this time to learn how to become the best possible father, to figure out how to provide for my family. One day, love and I will be buried together, or cremated, I haven't decided yet. and Detective Carr will undoubtedly spend eternity in a plot selected by his controlling wife.
Don't move, Detective Carr says. He leaves, and this is the most awkward time for me, when I am the most afraid for my safety.